Here we are at the end of Luke 20. I want to go back and pick up just a couple of thoughts from where we left off. Remember, Jesus dealt with the seven husbands for one wife and the mistake that the Sadducees made regarding resurrection. Israel was expecting a resurrection. They were promised a resurrection. They would, in Hosea 6, I will raise them up on the third day. Ezekiel 37, I will put my spirit in them, raise them up, give them a new covenant, give them a king, David, a shepherd, King David over them. And so they were expecting a resurrection, but there were always, in every culture, in every society, you're going to have this spectrum of people who believe that the spiritual is possible and those that be, yeah, that's not. And for whatever reason, I'm not going to try to expand on why people do not believe that God can do what he can do. But you remember in the Matthew account of this, or no, the Mark account, Jesus says, is this not the reason that you're mistaken, that you don't know the scriptures and you don't know the power of God? Which it brings an odd answer to any tricky question. And without question, the question of the resurrection, the question of the marriage of the Lamb, the question of the new heavens and new earth, the question of the last days, of the coming of the Lord on a cloud, those are tricky questions. Those are challenging questions. Without dispute, those are challenging questions. Jesus said, the reason you're mistaken is you don't know the scriptures and you don't know the power of God. I might say, by not knowing the scriptures, you also don't know the intent of God, what he was trying to do. It's so easy for us to be like them and superimpose our understanding of a concept or of a topic upon the teaching of that topic, and thus blur or obliterate or obscure the truth of God. But these fellows thought that they had a perfect foil against the idea of resurrection. This woman had seven husbands, they were all brothers, and so in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? That's a stupid argument to, and just because maybe your opponents can't answer it, doesn't mean it's sound, doesn't mean it holds, it doesn't mean it's true. And so here Jesus said, you know, the reason you're wrong, he starts off with that, the reason you're wrong is because you don't know the scriptures. If you really want to know what God is saying, you're going to dig in. You're just going to go with public belief, public opinion, the masses of Christianity, what they believe. Go with it. But if you wonder what God said, you'll dig in and be willing to go against the flow. You just be willing to take a stand on what you have concluded rather than on what somebody else has concluded. But after all, think about it. What you have concluded is your faith. What somebody else concluded, push comes to shove, you won't be able to defend it. You won't be able to stand on it. So you gotta come up with your own conclusions. And you have to be willing to buck the tide. You have to be willing to say, this is what I believe, and go with it. Anyway, with this, when Jesus said in verse 38, now he is not God of the dead. So, what did God say to Moses in the bush? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What did Jesus say about that? Now, think about this. How simple is that? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. How simple is that? I am the God. Not I was the God, or I used to be the God. That I was there. I am their God. But he's not a God of the living, of the dead, but of the living. Therefore, put it together. Draw a conclusion. Isn't it the reason you were mistaken is you don't know the scriptures? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's not a God of the dead. He's the God of the living, which meant what at the time that Moses heard that in the bush? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were still alive, even though they'd been physically dead for years. Okay, so Jesus expected them to be able to, wow, there is something about being alive after you physically leave your body, okay, or leave your physical body. Now, verse 39 said, and this intrigued me, and some of the scribes answered and said, "Teacher, you have spoken well." Alan, did you notice that it wasn't all of the scribes said that? It was some of the scribes, which paints a picture which we don't often wrap our minds around, is that Jesus was always speaking to a mixed audience. There's always this same spectrum of beliefs that we face today. People on the far right, people on the far left, and the whole spectrum in between. Some of them said, "You've spoken well." But look at the next verse. "For they did not have courage to question him any longer about anything." Why does it take courage to ask a question? Why did they not have courage to ask anything else? He exposes their ignorance. He exposes their arrogance. He exposes their incompetence. Now, you see the ignorance, arrogance, and incompetence of your spiritual leader. What are you going to do? Abandon yourself to somebody else. So we don't want to ask Jesus anything anymore. We're afraid to, because we will lose our following. That also indicates a rather chilling unwillingness to change what you believe.
Right. In the version that I have,
yeah,
where he says, "For they no longer dared to ask him."
Yeah, no longer dared. Okay. They no longer dared to ask him. What version is that, Alan?
Yeah,
English Standard. Okay. I use that as well. Good. Okay. So then Jesus posed a question. I'm going to ask you something. David, they say Christ is David's son. How? And, you know, we walked through that last week. David's son would obviously not be David's what? Lord. Couldn't be. But Christ is David's son, and in the spirit, David called him Lord. What conclusion can you draw from that? If the natural physical offspring of David could never be David's Lord, and yet by the Holy Spirit David called him Lord, what does that tell you about his offspring?
More authority.
He's beyond human. See? And so Jesus said, okay, he just exposed them for not knowing the scriptures and therefore coming to a false conclusion. And now he raised another one that they should easily be able to wrap their mind around. Oh yeah, man, that's interesting. David's son is called David's Lord. Therefore, David's son, the Christ we're waiting for, is more than just a physical heir of David. I mean, they'd have to come to that conclusion. Now, I'm going through all this again because we have the same kind of challenges. We're going to come up with verses that kind of, it doesn't make sense on the surface. Dig. Dig. It makes sense to the Spirit who put it there. And it can make sense to us if we're willing to work to find the answers. Okay? And by the way, do not worry or fret or be afraid of what people are going to think if you're digging for answers, because that worry will only keep you from finding truth. It's not about making people happy with you. It's about trying to understand what God was doing, God was saying. Devin? Thought you had a thought. Okay. So, in verse 45, "And while all the people were listening," that's our review for the evening, by the way, "while all the people were listening, He said to the disciples, "Beware of the scribes." How does yours read there, Alan? Beware of the scribes? Okay. Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love respectful greetings in the marketplaces and chief seats at the synagogues and places of honor at banquets. What's he talking about? What picture comes to mind when you read verse 45, 46, 40? Beware of the scribes. What picture comes to into your mind when you read that?
People who feel like they're more important.
People. And want you to feel like that.
Yeah, right.
Not only do they feel like that, but they want you to feel like that. Why is it that some, I hate to use this word, clergy, why is it that some of them put on special
not working
clothing? Say again, Michael.
Sorry, I'm trying to look for the mute on my phone. Mary was asking me.
It's on your phone somewhere. There, you found it. Okay. Why? Why do we have, you'll see them on TV. You'll see them in Safeway. They're wearing clothes that are not normal clothes, except for their rank and file. Why do they do that? To be recognized as what? What's the word? A man of the cloth.
Mm-hmm.
There's something special that I know more about God than you do. How do you know? Because I'm wearing this robe. Right? So there's a class of people that hasn't vanished that want to be noticed. Now, what's the first thing that you know about those who want to be noticed? They don't know what God said, right? Jesus himself said, do not be called father. Do not be called teacher. Don't wear titles that distinguish you from anybody. Don't go with special clothes that make you look different on purpose. And those who do that because they don't know the scriptures and they're not afraid of the power of God. So he says, beware of them. Why would he tell them to beware of them? Because they're there. And because they have the ability to intimidate your thinking. They have the ability to intimidate your free will conclusions. They have the ability to make you feel wrong if you don't agree with them. Which all that does is stifle the life out of your spiritual being. So beware of them. Beware of them. That's what they do. And he says they devour widows' houses. What does that mean? Devour widows' houses.
Yeah.
Pardon? Take their money. Whose money? Widows' money. Pardon?
Vulnerable.
Gullible. And yeah. And so they want to take advantage. They don't care about you. They don't care about what God said. They just want to be fed and admired. And they offer long prayers for appearance sake. He says these will receive greater condemnation. When God sees somebody purposely and intentionally duping people, I mean, why are widows giving them money? Why are they doing that? Because we want to support God's work. Say, oh, you're going to give us, you're going to, maybe we're buying a prayer cloth from you, or, you know, but they are doing it for spiritually driven reasons. And these guys are taking advantage of people who would spiritually give themselves to God. And so they'll receive greater condemnation. Now that gets into chapter 21, where it says, and he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a certain poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all. For they all out of their surplus or their abundance put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." That word offering is literally gifts. It's a gift, it's given to God, so offering is fine. But look here. The rich, who we just talked about, are bilking the women, the unsuspecting, and then they're putting in to the treasury, and here's this little gal put into. But you know what Jesus said in Matthew 6 about those who are putting into the treasury? He says, don't be like them. When they give alms, they blow the trumpet for the purpose of calling attention to the fact that they were giving something. They weren't doing it because of devotion to God. They were doing it because they wanted your praise. And so Jesus said, you see that? Watch that. Look at that guy. And I just picture him and his guys with him, just watching this fella doing what Jesus had condemned in Matthew 6, doing that. He said, you see what they've done? And then look at this little gal coming up here behind him. And she took in two pennies. So Scott writes out a check for a couple $100 on Sunday, Candy has 2 pennies. And she puts in 2 pennies, and Scott writes his check and kind of shows, hey, look, $200 check, and puts it in. Yeah, I know. I know. I've been meaning to talk to you about that. And Jesus said, she put in more than he did. How do you figure it? Linda, go ahead.
She just texted me and said she left the meeting because your voice keeps going in and out.
I am sorry for that.
Is it okay with Michael? Maybe it's Sue.
Michael, I got a question for you. Michael?
Sorry, I'm having to do this off my phone. I couldn't find my camera tonight. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Voice quality as I'm talking, is it okay? Is it in and out, up and down?
It's fine with me. I've got Bluetooth on, and I'm hearing it. I'm not listening through the.
Okay.
I'm listening through my.
It's not a matter of the projection. It's a matter of the reception. Okay. Can't deal
with
it.
You're coming through in Michigan.
We lost Jacobson. Pardon?
You're coming through fine in Michigan.
I'm making it all the way to Michigan. Just fine. Okay. Good. I suspect it because we've never had that problem. So it's probably on her end.
What?
You've come to an end as well. Anyway, I was really hoping she'd stay with us. I know she's going to enjoy what we're going through. Okay. So he's. Pardon? Your 2 cents worth. Okay. So what do you take from that? What do you take from that? Why were her 2 cents more valuable to Jesus than this rich man's, which he gave out of his surplus?
God wants heart more than sacrifice.
Heart of the sacrifice? Okay. Wasn't a sacrifice for the rich guy. Keep going. You're getting there. You're getting there.
He wants your heart.
Wants your heart. But there's more. What did she have to live on after she gave it? Her trust in God. What did he have to live on after he gave it? What was left over in his bank account? One of them totally depended upon God. The other one was making a show of their religion. Now that raises the question, what about me? In doing what I'm doing, I put money in the box every Sunday, except those when I forget. But I put money, or I have Timmy put it in for me. Am I doing that because that's the rote and routine that I'm expected to do? Or am I doing that knowing that I'm dependent upon God to be able to continue to do what I'm doing? What about you? Okay. And so we have right here from Jesus how he sees your gifts, how he sees your gifts. And he knows whether it's coming from, well, I can afford to give this because of it, you know, because I won't miss it. I don't think that little lady said that. Or am I giving this because I love God so much and I just want to see it happen? He said she gave more than they gave. But now look at this next story. And as he said these things, while some were talking about the temple, it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts. Now, I almost wonder if the two are separated or if they're, Jesus just got through saying she gave more than they did. And then everybody's looking at the ornate building. You know, the temple was plated with gold and had all kinds of ornamentation. That's a mouthful. And where did it come from? Came from the gifts, right? And she gave more than they did. You know, really? How many of gifts like her will it take to get a temple like this? You can almost hear the wheels grinding and the thought process. Or maybe I'm making it up, but maybe Luke is wanting us to see the juxtaposition of these two thoughts. But some people were admiring, and at least Jesus took advantage of it, right? Right on the heels of this, and that's the next story Luke told. So I'm going with my theory that there's this contrast between what people saw as a tiny little offering and the magnificent use that could be made of the great offering. It took a lot of money to get the gold up on this temple wall. And her two little cents ain't cutting it. And so I see Luke putting these stories in Jesus. That's the next thing he talked about. And maybe their question came because of that. I don't know. That piece I don't know about. But go ahead.
I wonder if it's the same people that were about the grandeur of the temple that were putting all the money in, because that would definitely, if it was them, it's just more self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm saying that whatever she put in was worthless.
Yeah.
Compared to what they put on.
I really appreciate that comment, Rachel. But they would look at her gift as meaningless, worthless. We can't get much done with two pennies. And so how do we look at each other's giving? Fortunately, I don't know what anybody here gives except me. I'm glad I don't.
I didn't.
I know you do. I'll strike you with ignorance. The gift of ignorance
works.
But and so they're talking about this, the temple and its beauty. Some rabbi said, anybody who hasn't seen the temple has not seen a thing of beauty. That it was, and a lot of praise in the ancient writings about how glorious this temple was. I mean, it was made for the only God. And it was made with that arrogance of the Jewish mindset. It's for the only God. It's for our God. It was lavish. It was beautiful. And so they were talking about that. He said, verse 6, these things which you are looking at. I'll stop right there and let you know that word looking at means to continuously gaze upon. not just glance, but focus on, intently stare at these things. And whether it's with a sense of awe and wonder, that's not part of the word itself, but the context would give you that idea. They're admiring the beautiful stones, the adornment and all that. He says, these things that you're looking at, that you're gazing upon, that you're continually gawking at, the days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another, which will not be torn down. All right. How does that make you feel if you are one of these that are admiring this beautiful building? How does that make you feel? Rachel, have you seen pictures of this? One of the places that I one day would love to go, the Opera House in Sydney, Australia. I mean, it's an amazing building. And we watch from time to time the documentation of amazing, how did they build that, so amazing architectural feats. You know, one day, looking at the Sydney Opera House and just amazed at it, one day that's just going to be an ash pile. Huh? But that doesn't really cut it, because what emotions did the Jewish populace have vested? Not just that it's a beautiful building, but it's our beautiful building. And not just it's our beautiful building, but it's the place where our God, the only God there is, comes to meet with us. And Jesus said, you know, days are coming when that's going to be a pile of rubble, not one stone left upon another, that will not be torn down. Go ahead.
Us, his special people.
Us, his special people, yeah. Right. Now, I want to take you over to the book of Micah and turn to Micah chapter 3. In Micah 3, Micah, same general time period as Isaiah, about the time of the Assyrian invasion of the 10 northern tribes. But Micah is talking about Israel. Verse 3:9. Now hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel. So Jacob and Israel, who abhor justice and twist everything that is straight, who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with violent injustice. Her leaders pronounce judgment for a bribe, her priests instruct for a price, and her prophets divine for money. Translation is, what do you want? What do you want to hear from God? Pay me enough and I'll tell you. Yes, yet they lean on Yahweh, saying, is not Yahweh in our midst? Calamity won't come upon us. We've got this temple. We've got this building. We've got God's presence. Nothing bad is going to happen to us. Therefore, verse 12, on account of you, Zion will be plowed as a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the temple, a high places of a forest. What's he saying? What did Micah promise would happen? And destruction, the temple, the mountain of the house, the mountain of the temple, high places of a forest. This whole area coming down because of your corruption. And verse chapter 4, now, where Micah 4, dealing with the tearing down of one stone from another of the temple that Jesus mentioned in Luke 21. Micah 4, 1, and it will come about in the last days, key in last days, Alan, last days of what? That's the question that has to be answered before you draw a conclusion about last days of what? Because I can read about the last days of Job. Okay, that's not these last days. But you know, it's the terminus of something. The last days of something. You get on a 10-day prescription of antibiotic. And you're on day 10. What day are you on? The last day. Okay. Okay, it'll come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of Yahweh will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh and to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem, and he will judge between many peoples and decisions from mighty distant nations. They'll hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. A lot of comments I'd like to make about that. Simply saying that Micah forecast a time when the temple would be completely torn down. And with the tearing down of the temple, there would be a new temple. The mountain of the house of the Lord will rise, be established as the chief of the mountains. And so with the tearing down of the temple would come a new temple. What did Peter say about that new temple in 1 Peter? Pardon? Say again.
Made with living stones.
Made with living stones. Jesus himself being the chief cornerstone, and you are the stones that build the temple. Now, I'm going to ask this question, because I know there are people in the religious world who are looking for a third brick and mortar temple built in Jerusalem. And my question is, why? Why would we go from a temple that God can live in that's made of humans and revert back to one that's made out of brick and mortar? So, with the tearing down of the temple in Jesus' day, it was like, you ever done any construction work, Alan? What does the term scrape and build mean to you?
Start over.
Yeah. Our friend Wally has done some scraping. He'll buy a lot that has a distressed building on it. It's already got all the infrastructure, the plumbing and the sewer, all the connections, electric, it's all right there. So he doesn't have to get permits and fees for that. But he doesn't want to just try to renovate the place, so he'll scrape it so he can build something new. Here, I'm going to tear down this temple so I can build something new, something better. Okay, so Jesus said, there's a day coming. And of course, if they knew the scriptures and the power of God, this would not be alarming to them to think of their temple being torn down. Because Micah said it would be. Now, it is alarming to them. Why? They asked the question, when? Give us a sign of when this is going to take place and of the end. We'll talk about that in a minute. But why is there this concern over the tearing down of their temple? Any thoughts?
Well, they know what that means. No temple.
The temple had become to them like an idol. They would swear by the temple. They would swear by the gold of the temple. They would. It was to them a relic that they could visibly see. Indeed, but that on steroids. Their whole life revolved around it because of its spiritual significance and because of it's our God with us. Okay?
Well, that's where they did their sacrifices.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also,
let's say no temple, it's no Jewish religion.
No authority.
Yeah, and so it's like we are obliterated. We, as a people, as a society, obliterated when that temple goes down. Now, the reason they would feel like that is because, one, they don't know the scriptures, and two, they don't know the power of God. If God is going to remove this physical building, will he no longer be with us? Or they knew, for example, the last 8 chapters of Ezekiel. They would know that there was a temple coming that could not in any way, shape, or form be a physical reality. You know, the simplest way I know that is because of the way that it adds up the property among the tribes. It's a perfect rectangle. Every strip is so many cubits long and so many cubits wide from top to bottom. And there's the topography of Israel isn't like that. It cannot be a literal temple being described by Ezekiel. But it's a temple being described with the glory of God coming into it. And so they would expect the destruction of the one, Micah 4, 3, and they would expect the rebuilding of something that couldn't be physical if they knew the scriptures and the power of God. All right. So, but there's a concern going on here. Let me get to it. Verse 7, Ron? Teacher, when will these things? Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, that's very good. I like what you're saying. I think also the whole relationship of Israel amongst all the other countries that were surrounding them showed mm-hmm. forth early in their history, from Moses to many other overcoming of other nations, that the God of Israel had a relationship with its people that were far above anything else that any of the other nations had, and that was centered in Jerusalem, where heaven and earth were together, and yep. God had they had a covenant relationship with their God, and like you say in Ezekiel, he left.
There are a lot of ways that we can embellish the importance of the temple, and so what I'm trying to do is get us into their mindset. If we hear that there's a day coming when everything that Jesus Christ accomplished will be destroyed, how do we feel? If we hear that resurrection and every cross on every church building or lawn will be torn down and broken apart and burned up, and everything we believed about the importance of Jesus will be destroyed, how would we feel?
Hopeless,
aghast, in deep, deep, deep denial, right? And so Jesus, look at this wonderful temple. You know, days are coming when not one stone here will be left upon another that won't be torn down. That had to hit like sledgehammer in there, almost to the point where, did I ever tell you about there was a large oak tree? I was cutting up firewood and went to my friend's father's farm, and there was a big old white oak round, about this big around. It had been down for 2 or 3 years. And I put my wedge and I tapped it in, and I hit that rascal, and it sucked the wedge in a little bit. I hit that rascal again, and the wedge popped up this high. That tightness of the oak just spit that thing back out, eyeball high. It persisted about 20 minutes. I got the thing to crack open. But there was the initial resistance. And I can imagine the same kind of resistance to this thought. Our temple coming down, this glorious thing, this precious thing, over 2 pennies. Oh, sorry. And they said, he said, look at their question. Teacher, when will these things be, and what this is the sign when these things are about to take place? When is it going to happen, and what is there a sign that we can notice when it's going to happen? And so they're really asking two things, but it's really the same thing. We're concerned about the tearing down of this temple. We want to know when it'll be, and how can we tell it's about to happen? Okay. And he said, you take heed that you don't be misled. You watch out. Now, when things get really smooth, it's really easy to find your way, know where you're going, what to do. But when things get all in a turmoil, It's easy to get lost in the shuffle, get confused, miss your turn, or you know, all kinds of things can happen when you are in an emotionally roiled up state. I didn't want to say disturbed, but emotionally roiled up. It's really easy. And then someone comes along that acts like he knows what's going on. Okay, I need somebody to follow. Jesus said, don't be misled. Now, what would keep you from being misled? I'm hammering on a theme here tonight. Why are you mistaken? You don't know the scriptures. Okay? Take heed that you're not misled. How can you know you're being misled? How can you know when you're being mistaught? I don't want to say lied to, because I think there's honest people that are mistaken. And they're not lying to you. They're telling you. Yeah, by the scriptures, as Mary said. We can tell what the truth is by the scriptures. Is this not the reason you're mistaken? You don't know the scriptures. Okay, so take heed. Be careful. Make sure that you're not misled, because many are going to come in my name saying, I'm he. I'm the Christ you've been waiting for. Did Jesus promise to return? When did he promise to return? I mean, at what period of time did he promise to return? At the end. What end? In other places, he said, for example, in Matthew 10, he says to the 12, you will not finish the cities of Israel before the Son of Man returns. He was going to return in their lifetime. Jesus promised to return in their lifetime. So someone out says, I'm he, I'm back. Who will be duped? The willing, the ones wanting it to be true, but don't know that it's true. Okay? So he says, don't be misled. Do not allow yourself to be misled. And some will come and saying, I'm he. Others will come and say, the time is at hand. You know what time it is right now? It's the time for strawberries. Now, in January is not the time for strawberries. You see how I'm using the word time? That seasonally fit time, that appropriate time, the time of expectation. The time of expectation of what? The tearing down of the temple? I mean, that's the context, right? The time is at hand. Hey, you guys, get your survival kit together, because it's about ready to happen. There would be people who would take advantage of people's vulnerability and susceptibility. By that, Jesus said, don't be misled by people pretending to be the reoccurrence of me, or selling you special packets on the internet of survival stuff. You know, the time is at hand. I'm modernizing the idea there for a little bit. He says, don't go after them. That's not what you're looking for. Verse 9. And when you hear of wars and disturbances, don't be terrified. Now think about this. Wars and disturbances. I want to go back and pick up a thought in the previous chapter that I had made a note on. It says, people saying the time is at hand. Back in Daniel 11. Daniel 11 is an amazing chapter. When we study the book of Daniel together, we'll see just how amazing it was. It's like Daniel's pre-thumbnail sketch of the next 300 years of history. And skeptics, it's the reason skeptics say that Daniel was written after the fact, because nobody could sketch out that much history in that intricate detail unless they had lived through it and studied it out. Well, Daniel did. And I'm not going to go any further into that, except in chapter 11 at verse 14, it says there were some who were trying to force the fulfillment of the vision. People who said, if we do this, we can make the prophecy come true. If we do this, we can facilitate the prophecy coming to pass. We have people today doing that very same thing. We got a red heifer. We've got pretty all of the temple furniture rebuilt. All we need to do is secure the temple lot and build a new temple on it. So they're trying to make a vision in their mind come true. People trying to force the vision and make it. And what's the problem with that? There are two problems with that, really. They don't know the scriptures.
They don't have the right cornerstone, and they don't have the right lilies.
Well, there you go. But I was thinking of it. They don't know the scripture. They don't know the ability of God. God doesn't need my help to bring the vision to pass, does he? He said, you watch out. There are going to be guys out there trying to make it happen. You just watch out. He says, there are going to be wars and rumors of wars, disturbances. Don't be terrified. Oh, no. Now, think about this sequence. People get agitated and malcontent over things going on in their society. We haven't seen that yet in ours, but people do. George Floyd doesn't count. People get, and they get agitated, and there's malcontent, and there's turmoil and disturbance, and sometimes uprising. We want to overthrow the government, we're going to resist, and then all-out war. See, all-out war doesn't just start. There are this buildup of malcontent. Jesus said, when you see that, don't be terrified. What happens when you're terrified?
Thinking right.
You stop thinking right. You act in panic. You act in panic, not in faith. You make rash decisions. You let what you see scare you. Yeah. And it's because they don't know the scriptures and they don't trust the power of God. So, you know, it's a theme that's running through this whole section here. And so he says, and don't be terrified, for these things must take place first, but the end, not immediately. The end of what? The end of what? He doesn't specify. But why would he use the term the end in this context? What topic did he introduce? Tearing down of the temple. What would that mean to the society if their temple is torn down? That's the end. End of what? End of our culture. End of our way of doing
connection
things.
With God.
End of our relationship with God. It would be the end of the Mosaic covenant between God and his people. Jesus said in Matthew 23, your house is left to you desolate. No longer God's house. It was the end, okay? For us to take that word, the end of the, and project somehow to the end of earth time, first of all, is outside of the context. Secondly, you ask yourself, everybody standing there listening to him say these things who are warned not to be misled, that's not the end. I'm talking about 2,000 years from now, or three or four. And they're saying, well, why tell me? There's no earthly reason to tell them these things if he doesn't expect them to be able to respond to them. Verse 10. Then he continued by saying, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes in various places, plagues, famines. There will be terrors and great signs from heaven. A lot of agitation and turmoil, whether that is literal or whether that is used representatively, like nations falling have been described as shaken by an earthquake. But there wasn't an earthquake. It was like what happens to a building when there's an earthquake. That's what happens to the nation when it's all shook up. Anyway, whether he's talking about literal earthquakes or the figurative meaning of earthquakes, he says, but before these things are going to happen, but before these things, they will lay their hands on you. On who? The people he's talking to, and will persecute you and deliver you to synagogues. Now look at that right there. Deliver you to synagogues. When did the synagogue cease to function in a new significant way? When Jerusalem fell. Now, granted, some kind of reinstitution of synagogues, but they're not the synagogues Jesus was talking about. Not the ones that the people he's talking to would be delivered to. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's so easy for people to take the thoughts in Luke 21 and move them down to the end of earth time. And there's no prophet in the Bible, old or new, that said anything about the end of earth time. When they talk about the time of the end, for example, in Daniel, Daniel talked about the time of the end in chapter 12. In verse 7, the angel raised the question, when will these things be? You know what the answer was? They will be when they finish destroying the power of the holy people. The context at the end of chapter 11 was Rome invading the Holy Land. I guess what I'm trying to say is that when the Bible talked about the time of the end in the book of Daniel, the end time, we're talking about the time of the end of the covenant of Moses and God's relationship with people through that covenant. Jeremiah 31 promised a new covenant. Ezekiel 37, at the resurrection of the nation, he would make a new covenant of peace with him. And so we're terminating the old, that we can establish the new. And he says so in Hebrews chapter 10, that he is taking away the old that he might establish the new. Okay, so a little bit of eschatology there, but just trying to keep this concept of the end in focus. The Bible writers, let me say it this way, Rachel. The people in the Bible were not concerned about the end of time any more than you are. You're concerned about the life you're living. Your dad's message on Sunday hit on that point. The Bible doesn't talk much about the afterlife. It talks about the current life, the life we're living. Okay? And so those people say, oh, the end of time. No. What about these things that we're facing today? The tearing down of one stone from another off the temple meant more than just our temple is going to go through a reconstruction process. It meant they were going to be invaded. Somebody other than a Jew is going to tear that temple down. How do we face the end of life as we know it, the end of our system? And by the way, the book of Hebrews really addresses specifically how Jewish Christians could deal with the end of the Mosaic sacrificial system, the cultus of the priest and all of that. Because all we're scroungy little guys just meeting in a house or an underground building, and they've got this glorious temple. Jesus said about that glorious temple, it's about to be torn down. The people in the book of Hebrews were encouraged to hold on because it's about to happen. And so, holding on to what you could see rather than what God had in store for you. Do you believe the scriptures? Do you trust the power of God? And so look what he says. They're going to persecute you. They're going to drag you into the synagogues and prisons, bring you before kings and governors for my name because you're a believer in me. And you might remember what Paul said in Philippians. I'm a prisoner in chains because of the gospel of Christ. But Jesus said it will lead for an opportunity for you, your testimony. You might think I've abandoned you, but the reality is I just put you in front of people that you can testify to. And if they see the depth of your faith, the quality of your belief, and the steadfastness of it, you might turn somebody to Christ in your imprisonment or in your torture. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourself. Why not? Why not have your testimony all written out and ready to go? Because my spirit knows better what they need to hear than you do. You just let me speak through you. For I will give you utterance and wisdom, which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. I love what Paul said in Corinthians 10. He says, the weapons of our war are powerful. They're divinely powerful. Overthrow speculations and every argument is lifted up against the knowledge of God. Our weapons can undo our weapons. Just don't think about it. Let God speak through you. But you will be betrayed even by parents and brothers and relatives, and they will put some of you to death. And you'll be hated by all on account of my name. Yet not a hair of your head will perish. Wait, Alan, figure that one out for me. They're going to put some of you to death, but your hair won't perish. Not a hair of your head will perish. The rest of you will be dead, but the hair on your head won't. Saying? What's he saying, Rach? Yeah, your relationship with God won't be damaged. Just be. And it gives back to what we had in chapter 20, the resurrection. If Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were still alive to God, right? What about those who forfeit their life because of their testimony? Still alive to God. You know how I know that? I want to take you over here to Revelation chapter 4. And we've got, it's chapter 6. 4 and 5 on the theme. Chapter 6, we're opening the seals, and he broke this. And then when he broke the fifth seal, the first four seals are releasing the various riders, the horsemen of the apocalypse. But the fifth seal, get, I saw underneath the altar. What's an altar? I saw underneath the altar. Yeah. Imagine the altar burnt offering in which they would slaughter the animal that's going to be offered up. And where would the blood go? Under the altar. It would go down to the ground, and they had a way to remove it, but it would be on the ground, basically under the altar. But the blood of the animal represented the life of the animal. Okay? I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell in the land? And there was given to each of them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest a little while longer until those who were to be killed, until their fellow servants and their brothers who were to be killed, even as they had been, should be completed also. The picture is, you had people at the time that John was writing this book who had already given their life for their faith, but they were still alive, as i.e. the hair on their head wasn't damaged. They were alive. And so, do you believe the scriptures, and do you believe and trust in the power of God that even if you give up your life for your faith, you're not dead? And that's what Jesus said back here in Luke 21. Verse 19, by your perseverance, you will win your soul. What's perseverance? Stay the course. Yeah. Bear up under the weight, the heaviness. To bear up under the weight and the heaviness is to persevere. Because that's how you'll save your soul. In Matthew 24:13, where Jesus talking started the same, Matthew 24, Jesus started in the same way, that not one stone left upon another. In verse 13, he says, those who endure to the end will be saved. Those who endure to the end will be saved. So he can't possibly be talking about the end of time. Ain't nobody going to endure to the end of time, if there is such a thing, until the very final generation. Does that mean nobody else will be saved? He talked about the end that came when the temple was torn down. All right, that's it for me. Any thoughts, comments, questions, objections, observations? What else can I say? Rebuttals.
The only rebuttal I have is I do know some people that are very well educated in the scriptures, but they still believe that that third temple is going to be built. So it's got to be more than just a knowledge of the scriptures, because they, they're missing a point. They're missing something, or they're.
Use the illustration, Mary, of a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And it's possible to have just a few separate pieces. And you say, oh, that's what this is. But then when you put them into the picture, you say, oh, that's what God is talking about. And some people will cherry pick. I almost said cherry chip. Cherry pick. I do that frequently. Yeah. They'll cherry pick key scriptures and plug them into their concept and say, see, here it is. And that's an unfortunate, what's the word I'm looking for? Study pattern, study habit. Unfortunate philosophy of Bible study is to make scriptures fit what you already believe. We ought to make what we already believe. Get go in with our coping saw. Okay? And you got to cope with the stuff that you didn't see that one. Coping saw, lop things up and your super glue and stick things on your belief system.
That's a very hard thing to do. It's so hard. Even though when I want to do that, it's so hard.
You have a couple really important sources. Number one is you can always ask your father what he's trying to tell you here. You can always do that.
Yes.
Number two, you have the promise that the Spirit will take the things you know and give you answers. Number three, you have surrounding you people who have studied the scriptures. And you do like Jesus did, sit there and ask and answer questions. The question is not, can we get there? The question is, do we want to get there? Are we driven to find the answers? Or are we just saying, it's too tough, I can't get there? And, only we know the answer to that question, but only we really suffer the consequences of that. Mm-hmm. I say that. Morning, as soon as I say that, you'll say, yeah, but what about the people that you influence? Yeah, they'll suffer the consequences of my not being driven to know God. So that's my answer to that, Mary.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I see it sometimes as a cop-out. I know what I believe. I don't want to upset the apple cart and study it more deeply. And it saddens me.